Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
at an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, it appears Chuck and Julie are taking the day off again. So last time when I guest host for them, I must not have done too bad because they're letting me come back again and do it again. So today, again, we're going to also talk about law enforcement stuff again. And John St. Augustine will be joining me as well. And we'll be talking about a case a little bit later on. Couple things I just wanted to talk about. But hey, if anybody wants to talk about anything cool or unique or anything, you know, feel free to call in. They send me a little thing. You'll see me constantly looking down here, all the logistics of what's going on with this podcasting, and they'll let you in. So if you want to call in, it's 888-627-6008. And you can call in and ask any questions. Like if we're in the middle later on, when John joins in, when we start talking about this one case back in South Carolina, you can ask questions and stuff about investigations, because like I told you, and I'll say it again here in a few minutes, you know, John and I have worked on numerous homicide investigations together. He was always the one that would call me up and wake me up in the middle of the night when I was sleeping so well and tell me that, you know, somebody got killed and I needed to get out there as quickly as possible. So we worked together on many cases. But before we get started talking about law enforcement stuff, I just feel the necessity the kind of like the stupidest thing I've heard in the last week. I mean, there's just some stuff sometimes that I see or hear that just make my jaw drop. And, you know, here recently, there's been a lot of things like AOC. I mean, she's just like the record book of stupid statements whenever she says anything. But I have to tell you, you know, I'm no big fan of President Biden. You know, a lot of people will watch his speeches kind of the same reason some people watch NASCAR. You know, they do it to watch the accidents. And every time that Biden does a speech or talks, I mean, it's a train wreck every time. He says something just so incredibly stupid. And you always have to rewind it and just say, you know, what did he actually say? And then when you rewind it, it's like, no, he didn't say anything that made any sense whatsoever. You know, each time I didn't miss anything. Well, last week, I have to tell you, I was just kind of chilling watching Fox News and talking about Biden meeting with Putin. And then they say that Biden gives Putin the list of the 16 critical infrastructure sectors that are off limits to cyber attacks. I mean, this has got to be the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. It's kind of like telling the school bully, don't hit me in the face, but everything else is good. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. But then I actually went out and looked just to see, you know, how stupid this statement really was. And as it turns out, the whole list of the 16 infrastructures are actually out on a government website, and they list all 16, and it's pretty much everything. But I noticed that they left out the entertainment industry. So maybe Biden wants them to attack Hollywood or something. But I just couldn't believe it when they said that. It's like, that has got to be the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. So that's my whole political section of that. That's it. No more real big politics today, other than when we talk about defunding the police again. So for a few minutes here, I just want to kind of talk, not again about the same stuff about defunding police, but there's just so many crazy things that are just going on right now. You know, I can't even believe they're still talking about defunding police. You know, most major cities that were very open about defunding police have very quietly refunded the police for the most part. And it was real interesting last week. I saw a story about San Francisco, and you probably saw that video where the guy goes into, I believe it was a Walgreens, on his bicycle. I mean, no one would normally do this. He probably didn't want to leave his bicycle outside because another homeless person would steal it. But he goes in there and he just starts taking stuff off the shelves, and security's sitting there with their cell phones recording this, and he's just taking everything off and no one's even trying to stop him. He's putting it all in a trash bag, and then he just rides out because he has his bicycle out of Walgreens, and no one even tries to stop him. And then they said, Well, Walgreens and CVS are closing down multiple stores in the San Francisco area. And then someone else said, well, that's racist. You can't, you know, Walgreens and CVS can't shut stores down. Well, there's a reason they're shutting the stores down. It's because they're not going to make any money if there's no law enforcement to make sure that people just don't go in and shoplift. So these major cities are just taking this beating, and some are trying to quietly fix things. Like Minneapolis is trying to get people back hired or get new law enforcement, even though they're about 25% nationwide of law enforcement have left. They're gone. So right now, nationwide on average, we're running with about 75% of the cops that we used to have a year or so ago. And another thing that I noticed, and I've got my statistics, I got my little card here with my statistics, and you've probably heard the old saying that there's lies and there's damn lies and then there's statistics. And I really hate the statistics that I've been seeing. You know, every night they talk about them and I see them and it's like, you know, at some point we're just going to become cold or frigid to this. 533% increase in homicides in Portland. You know, so who's going to go to Portland on vacation? Who's going to go to New York City on vacation? I actually like to go to New York City on vacation. I loved going to Washington, D.C. I thought there was nothing cooler than going through the monuments and all the museums. I just loved going to Washington, D.C. I just don't know if it would be safe to go right now because law enforcement's probably just not going to do anything if anyone attacks me or tries to steal my car or whatever. But last month, when I say last month, I think I got it from realtors.com or some website about real estate. I believe they were talking about the month of April, where existing homes are selling in the United States. And I just thought that was interesting. They only split it up into four regions. I would have really liked to have seen different cities to really understand which cities are growing and which cities are not growing. But they list it by region, and it's just basically the Northeast, Midwest, West, and South. So the number one area where the sales of existing homes was the South at 44%. Then the Midwest and the West basically were 43%, Midwest being 22% and the West being 21%. And the Northeast was 13%. So to me, I just saw that and it was like, you know, everyone's getting out of Dodge or out of New York City because there's just no law enforcement. And I'm going to bring this up again in a minute. Just something I saw today is that the district attorney and New York is basically dropping the charges on a lot of these rioters from last year. And I'm going to bring that up again because that's going to drive citizens, you know, residents crazy, even liberal Democrats, because they want to be able to walk around New York safely. That's probably the one thing that everyone agrees on is we should be able to walk out of our houses and just walk around the neighborhood or go to wherever and feel safe in doing that. And you can't do that right now. So, you know, there's a mayor race going on right now in New York City. And I thought it was interesting that the guy who's leading the polls, Eric Adams, is a retired cop. He's actually beating Yang. And, you know, everybody's kind of focused on that. So, again, little statistics here. So they did a survey. And, you know, they always do these polls and stuff to see who's leading in the polls in different places. So they do a poll to see who's leading in the mayor's race. And it's Eric Adams, the previous cop, and they asked a question. I just thought this was kind of interesting. Main problems facing New York City today. And understand this survey is not fair at all because no surveys are fair. I think everybody knows they're always leaning towards Democrats. Well, this one's way leaning towards Democrat. You know, if you read at the bottom of the survey or the poll, you can get kind of the numbers. 92% of the people who answered this poll were Democrats, which makes sense because it's a Democrat primary that they're talking about. So the top three, and everybody got to vote for three. Number one was crime or violence. What a surprise. Second one is affordable housing, which I guess is always on the top three list. And if you live in New York City, you would know that housing is ridiculous. And then the third one was COVID, still dealing with COVID. What I thought was interesting was some noticeable items that were not on the top three. They were actually much lower on the list. One of which being racial injustice. Okay, didn't even make their top three. Gun control, didn't make their top three. Police reform, didn't even make their top three. So I don't see this big urgency in people, you know, to want to reform police. They just want them out there and they want them out protecting them. And if you actually saw something that was said during one of the debates. One of the mayor candidates, when was asked, are you going to take guns away from police? She said, well, we're going to talk about that later. I'm not going to answer that now. That was about the silliest thing I've ever heard in my life. And she really took a beating over that. But one last thing I thought was interesting is that pretty much at the bottom of that whole list of what's important or what's the main problems facing New York City was climate change. So when it really boils down where the rubber hits the road, not too many people in New York City really care about climate change or their straws. But I thought it was cool that, well, not cool, that Eric Adams was at the top of the list being a retired cop. But understand that by no means is Eric Adams even a moderate or a conservative. He's extremely liberal in his views and stuff. They asked another question, should the NYPD put more officers on the street? Again, understand, it's 92% Democrats answering this question. 72 agreed and only 20 disagreed. So they want more cops on the street in New York City. And these liberal Democrats are completely missing the boat when it comes to, you know, people like law enforcement. They like their cops. And there's very few people that are actually being vocal about this that are trying to make all this stuff happen because they're trying to change our democracy in the nation. So I really wanted to talk about what I think is the epicenter of all of this, which appears to be Portland, Oregon. I just, whatever's going on there, even worse than Minneapolis and New York City, is, you know, they're still having these protests and things like that. But I actually talked to a buddy of mine who moved. She used to live here, her and her husband, good friends of the family. And they moved to Portland, Oregon about a year before all this happened. So a couple of years ago. And I called her up today, this morning. I just happened to remember, hey, wait a minute. She lives in Portland, you know. So, you know, I gave her a call and I said, hey, tell me how it is in Portland. And she started laughing. She goes, I live in South Dakota now. And I was like, well, what do you mean you live in South Dakota? She goes, I got out of there last July. That place is insane. And then she talked about some stuff. And I just asked her, I said, would you have felt comfortable going through downtown Portland? She goes, there's no way. I wouldn't go anywhere near downtown Portland. So all the stuff, you know, with Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and you can actually, if you're interested, I would tell you, man, you got to have more of a life than to actually go out and look for this stuff. But they've interviewed some people since Biden was elected, and they said, why are you still protesting in Portland? And they said, we don't care who the president is. We want everything. We want it all to go away, which is really Antifa and kind of their stuff, is they don't want anyone telling them what to do. And they want to be able to just move into a vacant home and take it over and things like that. They want the chaos and stuff. So let's talk about Portland a little bit. Last week, you probably saw that 50 law enforcement officers all resigned from the, I think it's called the critical response or rapid response team. Now, they resigned. They said it had nothing to do with the timing, but it was kind of coincidental. The same day that one of their members was charged or indicted with a little misdemeanor. And I'm going to come back to this little misdemeanor because it's kind of a joke. So when I went through that, I was like, you know, all 50 from this riot team, and this is really their highly trained riot team, and they're going out all the time, you know, like every night. So these guys, they actually made it their duty job. It's like, you know, that's all you're going to do from now on is just do riot control every night because of the craziness going on in Portland. So after many days of doing this, this is last summer, like in August, they're asked to go out on this one location in Portland. And then they're tasked. So I'm kind of giving you a background, what led to this officer, his name's Budworth, being charged with a class 4 assault. In the state of Colorado, there's only 3 levels of assaults. Now they call it battery, same thing. There's first, second, and third. Third degree assault in the state of Colorado is, did it hurt? So if I hit you and you say it hurt, that's third degree assault. You don't break any bones. You don't do any damage, really. It just hurt. Well, in Oregon, they have this fourth degree. And I looked at it briefly. It's just kind of like the same thing. It's like, you know, it hurt. So it's not a major deal or charge. So every night these guys, I say guys and gals in law enforcement, are out trying to keep the streets safe. Now, at first, when they're protesting because protesting is legal. Law enforcement is there to actually protect them and to make sure that they're safe and everything's going okay. Once they transition from a protest to a riot where they're causing problems, they're breaking the laws, things like that, then they transition from protecting the protesters to basically keeping the peace. So once they deem that it's a riot, that's why you hear in the news when they say, you know, they've deemed this gathering a riot, you need to leave. Now understand, once they deem it a riot, when law enforcement gives you a command, and it is a command to leave, disperse, clear the road, whatever, that is a lawful order. If you don't obey that, you're subject to arrest. Now, the reason why no one ever listens to what they say anymore is because nobody gets arrested. But really, in the old days, I don't want to say the old days, but basically they'd say, this has been deemed a riot. This is no longer a lawful assembly. You must disperse, and they don't. Then they start coming in and start arresting people. Of course, that doesn't happen in Portland. So that's what happened this night. They wanted to clear the road because they wanted to get some first responders in, I think, to deal with a fire or some situation. So the RRT team, Rapid Response Team, was asked to clear the street. And you can actually go out and see this video if you search, if you were to search for Budworth video, you'll probably see this video where a bystander, everything's videotaped now. You can see where this actually plays out. So you can see them all kind of marching out. But again, understand with video, this is typical on so many things that I've seen. When do people start running video? When something happens, not prior. It's not like, okay, in 30 seconds, something's about to happen, turn on your cell phone. So what happens is you kind of get the cell phone right in the middle of something that's going on. They're in the street. She's in the street, the individual. And they're saying, you can hear it on the loudspeaker, please clear the street. And she's in the street. So he uses his baton. It's a two-hand. He's not striking anyone. He's using it to push people. And he pushes her, and he catches her kind of in the wrong way as she's turned away from him. She's turned and starting to walk, and he pushes her. And she goes to the ground. And I've seen the video. I don't like the video. I don't think he handled it perfectly, but so be it. She goes to the ground, and then he goes, you know, he says that he thought she was starting to get back up. So he's anticipating where she's going to be as she's standing up, and he wants to do another push. Well, she doesn't stand up. So he pushes her right in the face, and it doesn't look good. I'll tell you, on the video, it looks bad. And he pushes her to the ground, and then he's like, oh, okay, that was a mistake. And then he moves on, and they all go walking down the street to clear the street. So that's the whole extent of this event. That event got her $50,000. That's what the city settled with her in a civil suit. So here's my issue with all this. It's not whether what he did was right or wrong. That can be determined later on. My issue is equal justice, enforcement of the law. So, and we've talked about this in the past, and this has been one of my concerns about destabilizing police. And the first thing is you defund them, and you talk about how, you know, you're going to take all their funding. They're all racist. And you saw how the Department of Justice has actually stepped in. And now they're doing investigations to like Minneapolis. And so every place that there's an event now, DOJ is stepping in and saying, we're going to investigate those people. The only reason DOJ would really investigate is for racial issues for the most part. But my problem with all this is they're turning all the rioters loose. They're actually, you know, dropping the charges for these guys. And at the same time that they're dropping charges for the rioters that are causing millions of dollars in damages and injuries to law enforcement, at the same time they're doing that, they're charging the cops for little things like this that are mistakes, little misdemeanors where they're making problems. That's not equal justice. So, and again, like anything else, they call it law enforcement, not law babysitting. So they're there to enforce the law. If you disobey the law, they're going to be physical. I mean, that's how it works. If you have to be hands-on, if you're not moving, they're going to move you. But what they're creating is this environment that the rioters can throw Molotov cocktails and frozen water bottles at the cops. And if the cops push somebody and accidentally catch her in the face, she gets 50 grand and he gets to get arrested. That is going down a road that is not going to help law enforcement. And I actually think that people are going to see this, and I think it's going to backfire on them. And it's going to cause a lot of cities like Portland to really be impacted. And my view at this point is, so be it. Let them be impacted. That's why I would not live in Portland right now, Seattle, Minneapolis, New York City, and all these other cities, because it's not safe. And I think what's going to happen is, I think their ultimate game, again, is destabilizing police. And they have these task forces that we've talked about, where federal law enforcement bring in local law enforcement, and then they answer to them, and they enforce the law on these different task force. It's another thing that could be an issue in law enforcement. I am concerned that the feds are somewhat trying to take over, and if not by taking over, intimidating local law enforcement to do things their way. But I would really keep your eye on Portland to see how it goes down. So the district attorney, this Mike Schmidt, for the record, he's an idiot. That's my opinion. And he's basically putting the rioters above the law-abiding citizens of Portland, and all of these liberal DAs that are doing these things are going to get people killed. I mean, that's the bottom line. So that's kind of my political part of all this in talking about Portland and defunding police and everything. So what I like to do now is, TJ, if you could bring in John St. Augustine, and we're going to talk about a case. No, I can't tell when he pops in. So
how's that, Mark?
There you go. I can hear you. So just to kind of intro for some of those that may not have been here last time, John St. Augustine was the commander of the El Paso County Sheriff's Office Investigations Division. I worked for him. I was a detective for about 10 years with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. I specialized in high-tech crimes, computer crimes. I did all the technology. So whenever you watch those cool shows like 24, I guess that's kind of an older show, but CSI or whatever, when you see the high-tech guy, that's me. John, really kind of his wheelhouse was inside the whole CSI business. But I asked John to bring a case, and this morning we talked briefly about the case. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have John kind of talk and set the table for the case, and then we'll talk about this case.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me on, Mark. In case anybody didn't hear, Mark's running for governor of Colorado at some point with his great political views there. So, right. Again, thanks for having me, Mark. You know, you asked me to maybe bring on a case and talk a little bit about it and some thoughts. And, you know, there's so many things going on across the United States right now. But one case that kind of caught my eye was a case that's going on over in, I believe it's Islington, South Carolina. And just to kind of give you a little bit of background on what this case is about and why it kind of piqued my interest was there was two people that were murdered on a basically a family farm. It was a 1,700-acre property in Islington, South Carolina. And a 22-year-old male by the name of Paul Murdaugh and his mother, Margaret or Maggie Murdaugh, were both found murdered there in near a dog kennel or near the dog kennels, there on the acreage. And it was a murder that happened in June 7th. And how it all kind of came about was about 10:07 at night, the husband of Miss Murdaugh, a guy by the name of Alex, I think his name is Richard Alex Xander Murdaugh. He goes by Alex. But Alex comes in about 10 o'clock, just sometime shortly after 10 o'clock. He discovers his son and his wife murdered there on the farm. I think what it is actually a hunting lodge. And he calls 911. And so the call initially goes into an agency, and I think it's called Colleton's Sheriff's Office. They actually responded, and I did a little bit of just background just to kind of see where Islington is. It's a small community. I believe it's like a little north and west of Charleston, and so I imagine that they don't have a lot of resources because they ended up calling what they call the SLED team, and that's the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division. And so some agents from the SLED team came out and took over the investigation into the death of both Maggie and her son, Paul. Now, you know, just some things that kind of caught my eye about this that is interesting is that why this is gaining a lot of international notoriety right now, a lot of things going on internationally focusing on South Carolina, is because of the legal prominence of this family. So the Murdaugh family apparently has lawyers in their family dating back as far back as 1910. And my understanding is that I believe it was Mr. Murdaugh, Alex Murdaugh's dad, who was actually the prosecutor there in that region that actually handled five counties there in South Carolina. And so, you know, as I start to dig more into this case, what else caught my eye was not only are we dealing with a prominent family, but Paul Murdaugh, the son, the 22-year-old, was involved in a boating incident where a young lady, a 19-year-old girl by the name of Mallory Beach, was killed. And I believe the allegation was that Paul Murdaugh was the driver of the boat. It was something that happened in the early morning hours back in February of 19. The boat came ashore. Miss Beach falls out of the boat, and they don't discover her body till like a week later. And so one of the things that raised a big stink there was that because of the family's involvement in the legal end, that there were things that were not done to Paul in the immediate time frame after this boating incident. What I mean by that is that apparently they didn't do a blood alcohol draw on him. So that was one of the big debates as to why wasn't that done. Like, that should have been done right away, because my understanding is that a number of kids were on this boat. I think there were a total of five, and they were all inebriated. I'm not sure about the victim, but what happened was Paul Murdaugh was driving. She ends up dead. Well, leading up to this death, just this year on June 7th, Paul Murdaugh ends up getting some alleged death threats. Well, that really piqued my interest because I'm like, okay, you know, what's going on in this case? You know, what else do we have that really just kind of stinks in this particular investigation? And why now, 2 weeks later? I mean, here it is. What is this today? June 21st. 2 weeks later, they still don't have an arrest. And you know, what's interesting is that the coroner's office has released some information saying that the death probably happened between 9 and 9:30 that night. But what really caught my eye was that they said there's no risk to the public. Now, how do you know, number one, that they were killed between 9 and 9:30? Because determining your time of death is voodoo science. Typically, what a forensic pathologist will tell you is that time of death can only be determined by when the person was last seen alive. So how does the coroner's office come out with this 9 to 9:30? But what also piqued my interest in this was that Paul was shot multiple times to his head area and upper body with allegedly a shotgun. And Maggie, the mom, was shot with an assault rifle. So, you know, you're looking at this going, well, this obviously was probably orchestrated. We probably have two shooters, because the likelihood of one shooter or one killer using two different weapons really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Well, I started to dig a little bit deeper, Mark. And the next thing I find out is that there were two other deaths in South Carolina that were also tied to the Murdaugh family. One of the deaths was the death of a 19-year-old young man named Stephen Smith back in 2015. And law enforcement found Mr. Smith with a crushed skull and a dislocated shoulder. But what really, you know, when I was looking at that part of the investigation, it said that Sandy and Todd Proctor, who were South Carolina Highway Patrol officers, both said that the Murdaugh family was associated with the death of Stephen Smith. But nobody's been arrested, to my understanding, in the death of Stephen Smith. Also to note, there was another death of a 57-year-old lady named Gloria Satterfield. She was the housekeeper for the Murdaughs, And here's the interesting thing. She's dead, but Alex Murdaugh, the husband of the lady who was just killed, Margaret, Maggie, he pays $500,000 in a wrongful death suit that was filed by the housekeeper against the Murdaugh family. And Alex Murdaugh paid the estate, I believe, of Ms. Satterfield $500,000. So this thing is really starting to unfold right now. You know, as I was looking at this some more, you know, I found out that, you know, like I said, Paul's grandpa was a prosecutor. But one thing, just last week, the local media there, and that is the Charleston Post and I believe the Courier there filed a lawsuit against Colleton and I believe the SLED team, because in South Carolina you have 14 days to disclose specifics of a case, which, you know, we don't have anything like that here in Colorado, and thank God we don't, because, you know, something like this, it may take much longer than 14 days to actually solve this case. You know, Mark, you know this. I mean, the Clements case, that took us, you know, we were working that for well over a year before I left. I mean, we were on it for a year and a half. But this case, you know, if we had to disclose things, you know, it could jeopardize the outcome of an investigation. In fact, it could cause a case to essentially be unsolved because, you know, if there's any specific details that are released by the investigating agency and the media gets wind of that, what's going to happen is that information becomes, you know, widespread. And now you don't have the ability to control certain things like, you know, caliber of weapon. Like I would have never released, you know, to the media, the caliber, like the fact that there was a shotgun and an assault rifle and that there's two different shooters potentially. Because as you know, we've talked about this in the past, right? The old saying, loose lips sink ships, right? More than one person involved, typically that one person ends up, there's a weaker of the two, and typically that person, you know, ends up being cooperative with law enforcement at some point in the investigation. Either they tell, you know, a loved one, they tell a spouse, a girlfriend, they tell a close friend, you know, this has been weighing on me heavily. You know, we were involved in a murder back in June 7th in Islington, South Carolina. And then the next thing you know, right, law enforcement is made aware of it. And that's what kickstarts the investigation. But this case is really interesting. You know, it's creating a lot of controversy, you know, there in that region because they're, you know, the fact that the family is prominent, the fact that, you know, there's some law enforcement background as far as prosecutors within the family bloodline with grandpa, and I believe, I don't know if the great grandfather was also involved in as a prosecutor, but you know, the fact
they all that, were.
Yeah. Oh, you know that, but the fact
all the way back, he was the first prosecutor in the county was his great grandfather. And then they've all been prosecutors ever since.
Wow. I just knew that it was dating back to 1910. And, you know, I looked at it, I'm like, you know, what's odd is that we're 14 days into this and typically something, you know, this big, very rarely does a case like this go unsolved, especially when you have multiple shooters. You know, somebody's probably already talked. More than likely, there's a lot of forensic evidence that was left behind, whether it's, you know, casings, whether it's potential DNA, whether it's potential, you know, blood stain interpretation, you know, as far as blood spatter. You know, there could be potentially some hairs, footwear impressions, tire wear impressions, you know, because we're talking about a hunting lodge. So, you know, again, what are the grounds like? What's around that dog kennel? But it's actually kind of surprising that, you know, there's not a whole lot of information being released as to, you know, the status of the investigation and you know, what's going on. My guess from a professional standpoint is that, you know, we're dealing with at least two people. You know, what we don't know is if there's maybe a third person who's a, you know, the getaway driver, and then the two who went, you know, went into the actual lodge to kill these two people. But the ties to the other deaths are very interesting to me. It's very intriguing. Right. Like, you know, how do you have this death of Stephen Smith, a 19-year-old boy? How do you have the death of, you know, 57-year-old Gloria Satterfield? And then on top of that, now you have this this case that was, I actually think Paul had three felonies regarding the boating incident or the boating accident out of Paris Island. where Mallory Beach was killed. And so, you know, when you look at these cases, you're like, okay, who could be the suspect in this case? And, you know, who could it be? I mean, think about it. It could be somebody that one of the grandfather or the great grandfather could have prosecuted and said, you know what, at some point we're going to come after that family. What a lot of news reports are reporting out there is that the focus was on Paul, that Paul was the one that had the death threat, that it was just by happenstance that mom was there, and that's why mom was also killed. But it appears that Paul is the target. And so, you know, what I would tell you, Mark, is in something like this, you know, obviously the technology becomes an extremely important part. And maybe you can elaborate a little bit about this. You know, we've done a lot of cases involving things where, you know, kids are on there with their Snapchat or their Facebook or their Instagram or whatever it may be, their cell phones are called detail records. But if you want to talk a little bit about that, I mean, I think that's probably, they just executed a warrant over at Paul's, he was a University of South Carolina student. And my understanding is they just executed a warrant there. They probably, you know, were able to get some electronics. They probably were able to get some things there. And my guess where the big break's going to come, if it's not somebody within the killers coming forward, it's probably going to be something on the technology side, because forensically, yeah, there might be something, but they're going to have to match it up to somebody, right?
Well, one of the things that you said is about the time of death and determining the time of death. Mm-hmm. Well, they have to, because like you said, that's kind of voodoo stuff. You know, they always talk about this on TV that, you know, they died between this time and this time. And you know, there's a lot of variables that have to do with actually determining when somebody died. But it could be, if that specific, and I'm guessing here, is that Paul was probably using his cell phone.
Yeah.
So if they know that his cell phone, and of course, the questions I'd want to have the answers to if it was me working on the case, do we have both of their cell phones? Was it on their pockets? Were they missing? And even if their cell phones are missing, we're going to get their cell phone records. And what's really good is, I mean, I'll tell you this, AT&T, like I said last time, they know where you are 24/7. If your phone's turned on, AT&T could come knocking at your door because they know where you're at. So they might be trying to say that this time of death was determined because he made an outbound call or an outbound text message. Or they there's a thing called a Cellebrite device, which they can download information off of the cell phone. If they could show that there was actually some activity on that phone that suggests that the user was actually using the phone. So that could really help on that. I'm also kind of intrigued why they're out by the dog.
The dog kennel?
The dog kennel. That doesn't make any sense to me. You know, and they should be able to tell potentially whether they were both shot there together at the same time, or if one was shot there, then the other one came out and was shot there later. I would think with blood spatter that they should be able to tell kind of, it depends. There's a lot of variables when you're working a crime scene. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on. And like you said, and we've seen this in so many cases, if there's more than one person involved, which is definitely the suggestion when you see two different types of weapons used, somebody's going to talk at some point. They're going to get jammed up later on. Or let's say there's a third person who all they did was drive. They can sit there and say, look, you know, I got jammed up on something. I can tell you about a double homicide, you know, and then, you know, so I'm fairly confident that something is going to break in this case. It is kind of interesting that it's been 2 weeks. They're just like with us, with the Tom Clements homicide, they're having trouble with leaks. Because the information that came out about a shotgun and an assault rifle, and of course, I don't like that whole term assault rifle. They're saying assault rifle type weapon. It's probably because it was a .223 round is probably, you know, based on the caliber, they're assuming it must be an assault style rifle. You know, we had leaks in the Tom Clements case that we couldn't keep things quiet. And we actually had, during that investigation, we cut off some people in the investigation in the loop because we knew that they were leaking information to CNN. So we kind of cut that off. So they have trouble with leaks. I think it's going to be interesting. Plus, you know, you said it was 1,700 acres.
Yeah, this hunting lodge. Apparently the family had property on this hunting lodge there in Islington, and apparently they also had a beachfront house somewhere on the coastal side of there on the east of where they were living.
It was something that large, 1,700 acres, because 640 acres by a mile. So we're talking a big space.
Right.
There's probably a long driveway. You know, so I just can't imagine how somebody could drive all the way back. I wonder if they hoofed it in, you know, parked someplace else and hiked in. Again, let's talk about technology for a second, because I think it, for me, I love the technology. The other stuff I could care less about, especially in a remote area like that. There's basically only today three cell phone vendors, for the most part, that really provide a network. You have AT&T, you have Verizon, and you have T-Mobile. Sprint is now part of the T-Mobile network, and they're in the process right now of rolling them all together. One of the things that people probably don't know about is that law enforcement can actually go to all three vendors. They write a warrant, and they say it around this date and time. So this was on June 7th, 2021, from 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, whatever, until 10:30 or whatever. I want to know every phone call that was made by all three vendors that hit the towers that would service that location. So what they do is, because every vendor has towers in different locations, the first thing they'll do is like, here's the location. So T-Mobile will say it would be this tower and maybe potentially this tower. And then AT&T say, well, it's this tower and this tower that could do it. And then maybe Verizon says, well, actually in that location, it can only be this one tower. Then they'll do what's called a tower dump, and they will download every call that was made during those 3 hours. And then they'll start backtracking and saying, do any of those numbers match anybody that would be interested? You know, and so what they'll do, one of the first things they probably did, or they may still be working on, every potential suspect, because in any homicide, the first thing you do is you want to live in their shoes. So you want to find out who are their buddies, who do they run with, who is, you know, their peeps or whatever. So they want to generate this huge list of suspects, and then they're going to get all their cell phone numbers for all of these suspects. And then they're going to cross-reference to those tower dumps. Now, here's what's so interesting, because I'm sure some people that are watching this are saying, who in their right mind would be so stupid to go out there and say, hey, I just killed someone, or I'm about to kill someone, you know, get on a cell phone and make a call. Well, in the old days, you'd have been great, you know, if you just didn't make a phone call. But today, that's not true. Today, you can call people, you can text people, or you can do data. And with data, it can happen interactively. It can happen on the fly. You don't even know it. Your cell phone's sitting in your pocket, and you're actually communicating to the tower, doing a data transfer for whatever reason, an email, whatever. Let's say you have some app turned on that's still communicating. That data is still flowing through those towers. So I find in a lot of cases that I work on today, because, you know, John and I are still consultants working on a lot of homicides through the state of Colorado and nationwide. We track that stuff in these data records. So they may still be compiling this list of who potentially, and then at some point, hopefully, if they get a name of a potential suspect, and then they look on that tower dump and say, bingo. Did a data transfer 15 minutes before the shooting, you know? So really the smart thing, and I mean, I hate to say this, is to turn your cell phones off before you break the law. But a lot of people just don't think about those kind of things. But yeah, this is kind of a case that movies are made of.
Yeah. So, you know, I was just, not to interrupt you, but I think one of the advantages for law enforcement, I think in this particular case, is that it's in such a rural area that, you know, going back to what you're saying, Mark, about using the cell phone dump, you know, it's not like doing something in Denver or Colorado Springs where you have a heavy population, you know, a few hundred thousand people, a million people. They're in rural South Carolina. If they do a dump of those towers in that general area, I think you're going to find that there's probably limited traffic on those towers. Especially in that, you know, 8 to 10 o'clock hour, you know, you're talking a 1,700 acre hunting lodge you know, it's obviously pretty rural. They may get lucky and find that, like you said, maybe I think that's probably where they're going to hit probably pay dirt, as they say, right, in the gold rush. I think you're going to probably get that, or it's going to be something on the technology end. Like you said, I think with the phone, if the phone was on either Paul or on Maggie, Miss Murdo, I think what you may find is that there may be something there where there's some communication. What will be interesting, you know, similar to a murder that I just did up in Denver, is that it'd be interesting if the killer or killers took one of the victim's phones, right? Actually took the phone from them, and then now we have them in possession of that phone in some location, you know, before they turned it off. It might help law enforcement to at least see if there was some, maybe some call detail records that were happening after that 10 right. o'clock hour, right? If that's the case, obviously the likelihood of that person being associated with the murders obviously elevates, goes at a much higher level, because what is the likelihood that that victim's phone would be in somebody's possession that had nothing to do with the murder?
So, right. And sometimes what you also find with technology is the individuals will think that they're being smart, and they'll say, you know, hey, let's turn off all our cell phones. Well, that's evidence in of itself. So what you have is you have this high usage of text messages, because young people tend to text a bunch, or you have phone calls, you have data or whatever. Then all of a sudden it goes to zero for 2 hours, and then it pops back on. And then when you're looking at where they're going leading up to when it turns off, they're heading right towards South Carolina to that location. The phone right. goes off for right. a couple hours. Then when it comes back on, they're driving away from that location. So sometimes just the fact that they turn the phones off, or their data usage, or their usage of the cell phone changes.
Right.
Typically, people after they kill people, they typically don't make a lot of calls afterwards. So again, they're real chatty before. There's nothing at the time of the homicide. And then there's very little traffic for the next day or two.
Right.
So technology is always a cool thing. Sometimes you do get the DNA. I always typically, when I worked on a case, whenever I went to go talk to somebody, I'd always look at their shoes. Because, you know, whenever you shoot somebody, you're going to have that blowback, that high velocity, depending on how far away you are from the victim. And it always gets on their shoes. But, you know, people are more than happy to dump their clothes. But it seems for some reason they just don't want to throw their shoes away.
Right, they got to keep those.
They love their shoes.
Exactly. They love those kicks. Yeah.
So they keep their shoes. And it just seems like it's always kind of interesting. And in another case here in Colorado, you know, we've still got about 7 more minutes or so. Uh-huh. Kind of related to the technology, if we can move on a little bit, mm-hmm. is the Barrett case up in Woodland Park.
Right.
Now, everyone's probably familiar, if you're from Colorado, you're familiar with this case. It was up in a mountain town, Woodland Park, up from Colorado Springs. They never found a body. I mean, for the longest time, you know, she disappeared around Thanksgiving a few years ago. They kind of knew they had this likely suspect and her boyfriend, because things just didn't make sense. I actually had a news channel here in town that actually got me one of the search warrants that the police had written to have me review it. And I just found it so interesting how the cell phone records were so instrumental. And one of the things that he did, and I've seen this in other cases, is they'll actually, like you said, they'll take the cell phone of the victim. And they'll say, well, I'll make it look like they're still alive longer than they were because, you know, they've disposed of the body. So they start texting amongst the two, or they'll, when people text the victim's cell phone, they'll text back. And the problem a lot of them don't understand is a lot of times we can tell which tower they're hitting when they're texting. And so you can track. And when you see these phones all using the same towers, you know, it can be a little problematic. And also the other thing that I, think people would find to be interesting is not only do they know what tower, because whenever you drive down the interstate or wherever, everybody can recognize cell phone towers. They can look at them and say, dude, that's a cell phone tower. What a lot of people don't understand is with the technology today, they can triangulate locations off of multiple towers. So as you're driving down the interstate, AT&T, Verizon, whoever, they have a pretty good idea exactly where you're at based on how long it takes for the phone to communicate with the tower, because they know the speed of light, blah, 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 blah. So when you're driving down a road, especially if you have AT&T, if right now you're driving down the interstate just feel confident that AT&T knows within a few, I don't know, 1,000 yards, they know where you're at, and they can track you. And Verizon's pretty good as well. So a lot of these technologies really come into play and are involved in a lot of these investigations. Now, I'm interested to see in this case how much technology is going to solve this case.
If I were a betting man, Mark, I will tell you that I think technology is going to be the centerpiece. I mean, you look at Barrett, like you were talking about, I think that's what really brought everything together was the technology. If it wasn't for, you know, the accessory there, I think her name was Miss Lee. If she didn't confess and she didn't, you know, they weren't able to corroborate it by looking at the call detail records from Kelsey's phone, I don't think they would have been able to make the association, the link as great without that technology. And I think what you're going to find in this particular case in South Carolina is that it's either going to be in the son's social media, the text messaging, who he's communicating with, or it's going to be like you said, they're going to do a tower dump in the general area, and they're going to find somebody who has a link or an axe to grind with either dad, Paul, or whoever in the Murdaugh family. But there's going to be a link there. Guarantee it. There's going to be a link.
Well, I know I would love to have an opportunity as many. I've gone through millions of call detail records or cell phone records. I love doing it. I mean, it's what I do now as a consultant, is I'm brought in mainly from defense attorneys to review these call detail records. And it's just so interesting on how you can track locations and stuff. And I love how certain people will say, hey, I was here. And it's like, well, no, you weren't. You know, you were actually over here. And I just got to say, for the record, and I know, you know, it's funny because I love to get political when the time's right. John doesn't so much. John likes to stick to the facts. And I can tell you this, kind of to get back on the first note, and I know John will back me on this. No one ever asks whenever we investigated anything, we never ask, hey, are you a Republican? You know, are you a Democrat? Or are you an independent or whatever? Wherever the evidence took us, that's where we went in these cases that we investigated. The facts are the facts. It knows no political backgrounds. And, you know, there's corrupt people, Democrats, and there's corrupt Republicans and things like that. But we had a great time over the years working together in law enforcement, working on these cases. And we're having a great time now working for defense attorneys nationwide. I'm supposed to be up in Alaska next month. And in fact, to kind of wrap this up, we only got a couple minutes left. So I want to thank Chuck and Julie for letting me do this. And I hope everybody was at least interested. We kept you interested. If you were driving somewhere, we kept you awake for an hour and listening to, and we're going to come back, in, I believe on July 19th is the next time that I'm scheduled to do this. I'm actually at this point scheduled to be in Fairbanks, Alaska, working on a case up there in a trial. So I might be doing this remotely. So you might see me from the great state of Alaska broadcasting on the 19th of July, but I can't tell how much I appreciate Chuck and Julie letting me do this. John, I know you love doing this as well.
Thanks, Chuck and Julie. Thanks, Mark. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so it's always fun to kind of do this stuff, talk about these different cases. And somebody, while we were going through this, someone brought up January 6th. Now, I know that's highly political, so John may want to step out of that, but I have some pretty strong feelings about July 6th. And I'll tell you just in closing, John, don't say anything.
January 6th, you mean?
You said July 6th. January 6th. January 6th.
That's right.
The invasion of the Capitol, where very minimal damage was caused. My biggest issue with January 6th, to be honest with you, just to throw this out there as a teaser, and maybe you can get me to talk about it later on, is the fact that a cop shot and killed an unarmed person in the Capitol, and they won't release who he was. That's not how it works. But again, not to get too political, we'll talk about January 6th later. Want to thank Chuck and Julie again for doing this. We'll be back on July 19th on a Monday, and we'll have a couple cases for us to talk about. So have a great week. Chuck and Julie will be back on Wednesday.